From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about Milwaukee's long history of drag performance. Then, why local home repair TikToker Mercury Stardust chose to focus her advice toward renters.
The reason why I focus so strongly on renters, if I can help them, I can help a lot of people. If I only focus on homeowners, I'm missing an entire group of people that might need my help the most.
Plus, we'll learn about the millions of cicadas emerging from the ground this summer.
Because they only come out every 17 years, you might only have a handful of opportunities in your entire life to witness these insects coming out in these tremendous numbers in the Badger State.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The cicadas are coming. You can expect to hear these noisy insects over the next few weeks as millions of cicadas emerge from the ground. We'll learn more about the periodical phenomenon later in the show. We'll start with this. There's an ongoing cultural conversation fomenting around drag. On the one hand, some drag performers have become the pinnacle of popular culture, like RuPaul or Milwaukee's own Trixie Mattel. On the other hand, states throughout the country are banning drag performances. But this contrast of high praise and criminalization has been a part of drag from its very beginning, as authors Michael Takash and BJ Daniels can tell you. Their book, A History of Milwaukee Drag, explores the roots and evolution of drag in Milwaukee, and how our current conversation echoes what we've seen in the past. Takash and Daniels join me to talk about it. In reading this book, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn just how early on in Milwaukee's history that we start to see drag performances. What was that like back in the, you know, late 1800s?
So the art of drag, as we know it, you know, as an art form, really began in the United States around the end of the Civil War. And there were a number of traveling minstrel shows that went around the country raising money for Civil War widows. And one of those companies was Francis and Kelly. And Francis Leon, who is known now to be the first drag performer in Wisconsin history, came to Milwaukee on June 7th, 1884, and performed a really groundbreaking show at Neunemacher's Opera Hall. And at this point, he was really at the height, if not a bit of a decline in his career. He and his partner, romantic and business, had traveled the world, had gone to Australia, to Europe, to Asia, performing these numbers in which Leon, in female attire, portrayed this prima donna, this woman who was being wooed by several men. And the audience was in on the joke that this was not a woman, but an actual man dressed as a woman for their entertainment. In fact, the Milwaukee audience reviewed the show after that June 7th performance and said that Francis Leon could make a fool of a man if it didn't know that he was a man. And most people in the audience don't believe that Francis Leon is male at all. So it was really fascinating to read this and understand like kind of what the mindset and the mood of the times were, which were, you know, that this emerging art form separate from the minstrel shows and evolving into something really dramatically different was happening at a time when, you know, Milwaukee didn't have paved streets. It didn't have electricity. Most homes didn't have indoor plumbing. But they had drag shows, and they were seen as a sign that Milwaukee was maturing and becoming more sophisticated and really not just this roughneck pioneer town anymore, but that we had arts and culture.
One of the running themes through this book is kind of the dichotomy with which we perceive drag on stage and then how we view female male impersonation, as it was called, outside of that context. One of the things that really struck me was the story of Julian Elting and Ralph
Kerwinio being investigated as a male impersonator, maybe even more stark at the height of the McCarthy era homosexual panic. We have a person like Adrian Ames, a drag queen, a leader of nightlife in Milwaukee. How do we square those disparities throughout this timeline?
Well, I think that what you look at is like what was considered entertainment, but that entertainment could not translate to real life. The thing is, these people were all okay as long as they were at a distance. When that was bridged and you came into, you left that stage in that other dimension, you kind of crossed that fourth wall, that was where the panic came in. Because then now suddenly it's something else. Now it's insidious, it's perverse, it's sinful, it's criminal. So that has been the dichotomy forever. You're okay as long as you stay in your place. The minute you cross out of that and try to, you know, mingle with the general public, you're a criminal.
Yeah. And that's a really distinct boundary. All of the people that you've mentioned were entertainers, and they were entertainment for straight people. They were not, you know, welcoming to gender nonconforming people. They were not welcoming to sexually diverse people. These were shows that were really intended for like upper crust, refined audiences. Whether it was in the 1880s or all the way up until the 1950s, when, you know, there was this drag craze in Milwaukee that it was on the level of RuPaul's drag craze today. You know, there were over 20 venues that had nightly drag shows, and none of them were gay bars. And that's the interesting distinction, I think, that we look at historically, is that up until recently, up until maybe the 1970s, drag was not seen as a representation of the LGBT community. It was not seen as, you know, a reflection of one's own true identity. It was seen as kind of like a carnival.
It was kind of like a novelty act.
Well, and that seems to be one of the big things that characterizes this pretty large time period, honestly, from the 1880s down through at least the 1950s, the kind of criminalization of being queer, being a female impersonator, a male impersonator, being in any way genderqueer. What did that look like during that time period?
Well, I think that the one thing that we're also maybe missing in this context too is that, you know, through Michael's research, yes, we had this huge explosion where in the 50s, not only Milwaukee, but really all over female impersonator shows. I mean, they were touring, they were doing all these things, right? But they couldn't have a real life. But now the funny thing is they are doing these things. They are touring. They're, again, it's like drag is really big, but now people are expressing their opinions. So we've kind of come full circle since the 50s, but in between that were all these other moments.
That's something that people don't understand today. And that I think was one of the biggest findings of the book, was that drag was not part of gay life until the late 1960s. It was not something that was allowed in gay bars. Drag performers or people who were challenging gender norms or, you know, dressing, cross-dressing as it was once known, were simply too risky to have in your property. They would attract attention. Many patrons believed that they were spies for the police. They were presumed to be sex workers rather unfairly. So today we think of, and you hear this rhetoric around, you know, drag performers inducing children into this deviant lifestyle. But I mean, for most of its history as an art form, drag was not something associated with gay people at all.
No, and actually it was kind of looked down on. I mean, the funny thing is I do remember I was not welcome at certain bars in Milwaukee, even if I wasn't in drag, because I was a drag queen. You know, I mean, and these are gay bars. And you weren't told that you shouldn't be there at the Rec Room or these, you know, quote unquote, you know, men's bars. But they let you know that your presence wasn't something that they liked until AIDS. I think AIDS changed everything.
It's interesting looking at the book. You have this time period called the Golden Age of drag. I think it was 1981 to 1991, something like that. And when I think of that time period in LGBTQ history, I, of course, think of this deadly pandemic that was killing so very many young men. What made that moment a golden time for drag, despite the other things that were happening?
The shocking discrimination, the fear-mongering, all of a sudden, your presence on stage was needed to shore up the troops, if you will. People went out to clubs throughout the 80s as a measure of support. And so in a strange way, the LGBT community really came together, and Queens led the way because they were there. They were the ones that were on stage. They were the ones that were out in front.
And another point is that, you know, even before AIDS arrived, we think now in retrospect that the 80s was a decade that was, you know, completely tainted by AIDS. And it was in the later half of the decade, mm-hmm. at least in Wisconsin. But the first half of the decade was very different than we remember it. I mean, we were coming out of the disco era. There was this great sense of liberation and accomplishment and momentum and movement for gay rights. And there was this great sense of access and integration due to the disco movement. Discos were places that, like, everyone came together from across, you know, racial and sexual and, you know, economic backgrounds. And nowhere demonstrated that better than the gay bars of the era, like Circus or the Red Baron or Park Avenue. So looking at the success of those venues, they were, again, very pioneering investors who created these new spaces and really ramped things up.
It feels like right now we're in a different kind of golden age of drag as a result of RuPaul's Drag Race. Your last chapter, of course, deals with this a lot. We have two winners from Milwaukee, Trixie Mattel and Jada Essence Hall. We have another queen from Milwaukee who is just on the current season of Drag Race, James Mansfield. How has that Drag Race, how has that changed the drag world we see now in Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's like we're going back to the 50s again. I remember when RuPaul's Drag Race first started on TV, and it was very like niche, you know, like it was just you were sharing this with a few of your friends. And you're like, oh, my God, did you see that show? It's called Drag Race. And it's and then all of a sudden it was like, you know, their sister started watching it with them, then their mom, you know, and all of a sudden, I think, honestly, the show became a phenomenon because it was so accessible to like the general public. There was a fallow period there that then got this dramatic uplift in the 2000s because of the show. And from there, you know, sprang all these other stories of people who said, wow, you know, now there's something more to aspire to than just a local title, you know, a local booking. Drag queens started looking at things differently. And the fact that so many people came from Milwaukee and from the Milwaukee drag scene that have been able to achieve all this success, I think, especially Jada and Trixie, they're both two sides of a different coin. Jada is just this really talented makeup artist, designer, hilarious, you know, all these things. Trixie is a writer, a musician, a comedian. I'm not surprised. I think Milwaukee's always had a really big creative community. And I think RuPaul's Drag Race kind of pushed it forward. And then, of course, two Hamburger Marys opening here. It was a cool thing to go see drag shows again. So all of a sudden, I think it really, all those things converged in one.
And I think that they all converged on a foundation that people didn't even know they had. And I think that is probably one of the most startling things about my work and our work as a history project. There's this whole extensive history out there and heritage that so few people know about and so few people even realize influenced them in so many ways. The structures and the connections and the traditions and the rituals that, you know, were founded over this long series of seven generations is what bred these modern day RuPaul superstars. I mean, they came up in an environment that was had all of these influences and all of this precedent, and they benefited from it and flourished. And I think that that's amazing. I mean, I think back to, you know, the 50s and the 30s and the even the 1910s and what those people would think if they knew that 100 years later, there were international superstars coming out of Milwaukee doing drag. I think it would just blow their minds.
BJ, Michael, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks
for having us.
Michael Takash and BJ Daniels are co-authors of A History of Milwaukee Drag, Seven Generations of Glamour. Takash is a curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. Daniels is a legendary Milwaukee drag queen who is being honored by Milwaukee with a commendation for his contribution to the city's LGBTQ community. We spoke last summer. Despite a potential ban on the app, TikTok is a place that many people go for useful information. There are videos on everything from crafting and recipes to gardening and home repair. That's where Mercury Stardust comes in. The Wisconsin TikToker is known as the Trans Handy Ma'am, and her platform helps people learn how to fix up their homes and highlights issues important to the trans community. Stardust's book, Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair, was released last summer. That's when we spoke about her work. I am someone who has watched your TikToks a number of times. Why did you first decide to start doing TikToks, get into this space?
Well, I was a burlesque dancer here in tropical Madison, Wisconsin, and a friend of mine said, hey, you should do TikToks to promote your show that's online. And I said, no one's going to watch that. And, you know, I got on TikTok for like a few weeks and I was just doing little fun videos. And one day someone posted a video where they needed help with a ratchet strap and they were getting made fun of in the comments. So all I did was post a video in response, trying to help them in a way that I would have wanted someone to help me when I was younger. And it really seemed to resonate with people. And I really enjoyed helping one person. So I kept on doing it. And then it just kept on going.
Most people who do this work are men. What has it been like for you working in this space as a handy person, especially as someone who has transitioned?
It sometimes can be a little bit of an uphill battle, right? Like when I'm in a room, more times than not, there's probably more men in that room than any other, you know, category of people. And it can be a little difficult sometimes to get a word in edgewise. But what has always really helped me is just staying true to who I am. I'm not there to necessarily impress anybody. I'm just there to be who I am. And I know that I'm really good at my job and I know I'm really knowledgeable. And that's always really helped me get through those moments. But yeah, it has been difficult at times.
Have there been any obstacles that surprised you?
I think when I came out a few years ago and people at the property company that I worked at, everyone was pretty cool with it. But when I would go into tenants' homes, sometimes tenants would not want to have me come in. Sometimes they would say, I don't want it to come into my home and say some derogatory terms at me. Those have been difficult. And I think I knew that going in, that was always a chance that could happen. But I didn't realize to what extent people's bigotry would prevent them from seeing that all I want to do is help people and there's no agenda attached to it.
Sure. Now, it seems like your TikTok space is a pretty open and welcoming space, but in your work on the day-to-day, would you say that normally people are pretty cool or are people kind of terrible?
Well, the good thing about being on TikTok now is anyone who works with me, anyone who seeks me out, they know exactly who I am and they know what I stand for. So I don't really work with or work around people who might have bigoted views about trans people. People seek me out, and because I am a trans person in this field, in a lot of ways, I'm like their favorite thing to reach out to, right? Like I'm doing quite well because I'm so different in the industry, and because I think differently, and I educate differently, and I do things ultimately not like what the status quo is. People seek out my knowledge rather than just happen to find it.
I mean, that makes me think of the first time I saw your TikTok, I went, this is a woman from Wisconsin. You don't get that accent from anywhere else. I don't know how big TikTok is in the state. I assume it's like anywhere else. Do you find you have this new celebrity status here?
You know, I want to say no, but it's a little overwhelming sometimes, you know, depending on where I am in the state. Like, the people who are on TikTok, it's overwhelmingly queer people who follow me. But when people recognize me, by the very nature of the beast, they're typically people who are, you know, they're an up and up. They're cool with the trans community and the LGBTQIA community. So I don't get too nervous, but every once in a while I'll be at Home Depot or I'll be, you know, at Menards and someone will scream across the aisle, "The trans handyman," and I get a little nervous to say the least. You know, being recognized so openly and loudly as a trans person in public can sometimes be nerve-wracking. But it's been a real wonderful thing. People tell me their stories about how I help them all the time. And that's just so wonderful. And what a privilege to have to help so many people.
I mean, one of the things that is really interesting about your content, but also, of course, your new book, you focus on a group that most of us have found ourselves a part of at one point or another, renters. What made you want to focus on the needs of renters versus homeowners?
Well, my ideology when it comes to activism has always been linked to intersectionality. And in intersectionality, we believe very firmly in order to help one marginalized group of people, you have to help the people who are the most vulnerable. So we often talk about the Black trans community being the community we want to help the most. Take that same type of logic and you put that into the homeowner space and you put that into a DIY space. What that end up becomes, it becomes renters. Because if you can help a renter, you can typically, sometimes, most of the time, help a homeowner. Most homeowners have been renters in their life, but most renters will never be a homeowner. And I think that that is a really important distinction. And the reason why I focus so strongly on renters, if I can help them, I can help a lot of people. If I only focus on homeowners, I'm missing an entire group of people that might need my help the most.
What are some of the challenges that face renters specifically?
Often landlords will be the problem. You know, I'm not necessarily against landlords entirely. I think that there's a lot of landlords who are trying their best to be as ethical and really do care about their tenants. But there are a significant amount of landlords who don't try to have a good, healthy communication with their tenants. And that leads to problems. When a tenant learns that when they ask their landlord for help, there's a very good chance they might not do anything, or they're going to yell at them or blame them initially, then the problem becomes that that person who's a tenant won't ask for help next time when there's a larger issue. And that breakdown of communication can lead to a huge headache for me when maybe there's a faucet that just keeps on leaking. And instead of solving it, they just let it be pushed off. And that becomes a massive issue. Or worse yet, when they move out and I'm doing the turnover, that could be a huge issue and cost thousands of dollars. And that in turn hurts other tenants. It hurts all the other tenants who are attached to that property management company.
Sure. Is there advice that you find yourself returning to time and again for people who are renting?
It's always to document everything. Document, document, document. If you're having an in-person conversation with a landlord, yeah, that could be perfect for so many reasons to have that interpersonal relationship. But it's important to make sure that you go back and you email them and you do a recap of everything you talk about. If you talk to them on the phone, make sure that you text them and do the same thing. Having that chain of documentation of what was said, when things will happen, and when things have gone awry is so important to protect us legally, but also to protect us from them and ourselves.
As you look at your own experiences, do you have advice for other women, other trans women who are interested in handiwork, but leery of being in a space that has been generally dominated by men?
This space is filled with jobs where we work alone most of the time. As a maintenance technician, I didn't have to work with a lot of people all the time. It's a great job to be an individual, to rely on your own skills, to help people directly. There are opportunities and chances when we will be working with people who probably don't have our best interests in mind and view us not favorably. But the reality is this, our skill far exceeds people's expectations almost all the time because we often have to be. Women, trans people, LGBTQIA people in the field typically have to be extremely good to get anywhere in this industry. And that often means that we impress people around us. So don't allow other people's perception of you to be your reality.
All right. Well, Mercury, thank you so much for speaking with me today about your work.
Thank you, Joy, for having me.
Mercury Stardust is a Madison-based TikToker known as the Trans Handy Ma'am. We spoke last summer. Her book, called Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair, is available now. There are zombies among us. Zombie trees, that is. We'll tell you what they are, the causes, and possible solutions in about 20 minutes. But first, we'll learn about the millions of cicadas emerging from the ground this summer. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The cicadas are coming, millions of them. The country is buzzing this year for an epic insect event, the emergence of two different broods of periodical cicadas. One group appears every 13 years, another group, brood 13, appears every 17 years. The last time the two broods overlapped was 1803. Before Wisconsin was even a state. Southern Wisconsin is home to Brood 13. To learn more about the cicadas and how to experience them, WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with PJ Leash, an entomologist with UW-Madison Extension.
What can we expect this summer?
Well, in just a few weeks or about a month or so, things are going to get pretty noisy in some parts of Wisconsin, and that's because of the emergence of our Brood 13 periodical cicadas, which have a 17-year life cycle. So they were last out in 2007 and prior to that back in 1990. And you can keep counting backwards all the way into the 1800s. But these insects are really fascinating because they emerge at these long extended time intervals of 17 years. It's a little mind-boggling to think of an insect living that long period. But they come out at these long time intervals and also in massive numbers. And that might be part of a survival strategy, because if you come out in such massive numbers, and these insects are fairly clumsy, so vertebrates like birds and mammals and fish are going to gorge themselves on these things. Plenty of the cicadas will be eaten, but there's going to be lots more that can still survive and reproduce. So that makes these insects pretty unique. So some parts of the state will have these coming out in huge numbers, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in relatively small areas.
That is so cool. What kinds of conditions are the cicadas waiting for?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. These insects have been feeding below ground for essentially 17 years at this point. They feed on the roots of trees. And in that 17th year, they are waiting for the soil conditions to be just right. And we know from some scientific studies, a key factor for emergence is the temperature of the soil at a depth of 8 inches. It has to get above 64 degrees Fahrenheit. I've been checking weather stations around the state, and at the moment, soil temperatures in southern Wisconsin are in about the mid to higher 50s. So we're getting close, a couple more weeks, and we're going to be in that temperature range that they need. So we have to hit that soil temperature of 64 degrees at a depth of 8 inches, and that won't necessarily trigger it immediately. It kind of primes the system, so to speak. But around that same time, if we get a decent rainfall and that rain percolates down into these channels, that also seems to spur on the activities. So again, it's just going to be a few weeks away for some parts of Wisconsin.
So they spend most of their lives underground. You know, what does the best summer ever look like to a periodic cicada? And how does emergence fit into their life cycle?
Only adult insects can reproduce. So they are juveniles below ground. They are going to come out of the ground, crawl out, and then the juveniles are going to climb onto vertical surfaces. That could be the trunk of a tree or a fence post or something else nearby. They are going to molt and leave that old exoskeleton behind, and you'll see those around. Those will be evidence of molting. But once they molt and they transform to the adult stage, it takes a little while for them to darken and harden, and those adults will only be out for about a month. So really, statistically speaking, 98% or so of their entire life is spent below ground in the dark, feeding on tree roots. They come out for about a month as adults. The main goal that they have is to find a mate. And the way to go about doing that is to make a lot of noise. Specifically, the males have these membranes on the side of their body called timbals. And it's like the membrane on a drum. You can use muscles to cause vibrations, and that produces the sound. So for this month or so while they were out, it's the males essentially singing or screaming to attract the attention of females for mating purposes. The females can't sing back, but at a close range, the females can snap her wings. And it's going to sound just like someone snapping their fingers. And so you get this little back and forth calling between males and females. Eventually they mate. The females will then lay eggs. And a few weeks later, they're done and gone for 17 more years.
And the young cicadas will head back underground for the next 17 years.
Not immediately, though. It turns out what the females do is they will go to small twigs. They're really fond of twigs on trees that are about the diameter of a pencil, give or take. And so the female has this egg-laying structure that under the microscope, it looks like a spear or a pocket knife. She'll literally cut slits into these twigs and then insert batches of eggs. And those eggs will sit there for many weeks, maybe somewhere in the ballpark of 6 or so weeks. Then this very small juveniles come out of those eggs and they drop down to the ground. They rain down to the soil, but they're so small, it's probably going unnoticed. At that point, they burrow below ground where they're going to hang out there for 17 more years.
When they're underground, are they in like a dormant state?
Yeah, it would depend on the time of the year. So they are actively feeding and growing and developing over the course of those 17 or so years below ground. These insects, both as juveniles and adults, have tubular mouth parts, somewhat like a mosquito, except they use these to poke into it and pierce tree roots, and they drink sap from those trees. So the juveniles below ground are actively feeding on tree roots. When the temperatures decline in the fall and during the winter months, it's going to be too cold and their activity is essentially going to cease. But then during the warmer months, they are going to be actively feeding and growing and developing.
What is this life cycle an evolutionary response to? Like, why do we think that they do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And partly, we don't fully understand. We can speculate and make some educated guesses that might explain, but still, there's some unknowns about their biology. One thought, though, is that if you are an insect that emerges in tremendous numbers on a very regular basis, say every year or every other year, in that case, animals that feed on you are going to catch on, because if raccoons and skunks and birds know they can rely on you on an annual basis, their populations are probably going to increase. That's probably going to decrease your populations because there's more of them to feed on you as cicadas. But if you come out at these very long time scales, most other forms of wildlife, vertebrates, birds, and mammals probably aren't living quite that long, so they can't catch on to this pattern. And so that's thought that evolutionarily, it might help with their survival. Again, it goes hand in hand. You emerge at these long time intervals, but you do so in such massive numbers that you overwhelm and essentially satiate anything that feeds on you. They're going to have full bellies, and there's still plenty of cicadas around to mate and successfully reproduce.
Right, right. So what kinds of threats do cicadas face? You know, I'm thinking about all the development that could happen in a 17-year period, or how climate change might throw them off.
My impression is that on shorter time scales, you know, in our lifetime, probably the biggest immediate threat to them would be land use changes, because the cicadas feed on tree roots, and those trees need to be there for very long periods of time. And so if those trees are cut down for an agricultural field or a parking lot or housing or whatever other purpose, and those trees are cut down and gone, the cicadas that were feeding on those roots will die out in those spots. So over time, the range of these insects, it's probably shrinking due to land use changes. Here in Wisconsin, for example, we historically have had records in counties like Waukesha, Milwaukee County, but I have not seen any confirmed reports from counties like that in really decades. Some other areas, just as an example, historically, we had some documented here in the Madison area, but the last record of those I could find was 1956. They haven't been spotted in 60 to 70 years at this point. So those land use changes can be a really important threat to cicadas, kind of in a shorter immediate time scale. But when you think about climate change, we don't fully know what that is going to mean for cicadas. One thing that is almost certainly going to happen is if we have changing climate, we have earlier springs as an example, that's probably going to shift their emergence time. So they'll pop out and emerge earlier in the year. What will the impact of that be? It's really hard to tell at this point. One other potential complication, though, is if with climate change, we get more extreme weather swings. And if you had years where you maybe had an early warm up in, say, February, and then it got brutally cold again in March, just these weird weather swings, that might have some potential impacts on these insects in the long run. There's been some hints at that in the literature where you have an early warm up followed by a frost. And if that has an impact on the host trees and some changes in the phytochemicals within the plant, that might have some subtle impacts on the cicadas too. But for the most part, we don't fully understand what these changes will mean for these insects in the long run.
So you've been poring through all of those historical records, trying to understand where they'll occur. Where can folks in southern, southeastern Wisconsin go to experience this themselves?
Yeah, so there's a number of spots tucked around. And what I did this last winter, I dug through about 150 years of old newspaper articles, government reports, and other documents to try and find our best idea of where these occur. Because one really important thing to understand about these insects, and this is often overlooked, is they can be really geographically isolated. And I've been telling folks their distribution, it's like pins on a map. So some of the maps going around will shade in entire counties, giving the impression that they're widely distributed everywhere, which isn't the case. They're restricted to individual isolated geographic spots on the map. So in southern Wisconsin, perhaps the single best spot to see them would be the Lake Geneva area. I have seen records from that part of the state going back well into the 1800s. We also know there's some decent populations near Beloit, near Janesville. There's one particular park just northwest of Janesville. It used to be a Boy Scout camp. Now it is Rock River Heritage County Park. And there was a strong emergence noted there in 2007. We've got some activity noted in Spring Green and a lot of tucked away spots in Iowa County as well. But if you want to know more about the distribution, earlier this year, I released a periodical cicada website for the state of Wisconsin. It's cicadas.wisc.edu. And on that site, I actually have a page dedicated to when and where they occur. And it includes a map with this research I've done and also a column going county by county talking about some of the important locations.
Are there things that we don't know about cicadas that entomologists like yourself hope to use this summer to explore or get more information on?
Yeah, that's a great question. From my standpoint, my main interest at the moment is to get a better feel for where these insects really occur in Wisconsin. And again, we talked about some of the threats that might be impacting where they occur in the state. Maybe they were in spots historically and no longer occur there. We know that's the case here in Madison. And so on that cicada website that created, I actually developed a community science project. So folks can go on there and submit sightings from within Wisconsin. And I'd really love to hear about any sightings to help fine-tune our map and better understand where these occur. But there are some other really cool research questions that have been asked by scientists out there. One thing that I've heard discussed recently that we just don't fully understand, as an example, is how the cicadas know to all emerge at the same time. We talked about soil temperatures and rainfall can influence them, but how do they really know to emerge at the same time? What if some emerged early? Mm-hmm. Those would probably get picked off by birds or other wildlife. That is a mystery we don't fully understand at this point. I'd love to see someone try and figure that out.
That is really exciting.
One thing I would mention, and this is a common question that I've gotten from the public, is are these cicadas harmful or dangerous in any way? Wildlife is going to gorge themselves on these things. They are pretty palatable. Humans can even eat them. If you go online, there's a lot of recipes. So they're really quite harmless to people. They really don't bite. They can't sting you at all or anything like that. They technically can cause a little bit of damage to plants, and that is when the females go to lay eggs. Again, she uses that spear-like egg-laying structure called an ovipositor. She cuts these slits in small twigs, and that can cause those twigs to die and break off. So those leaves will turn brownish. If this occurs in those twigs snap, we call it flagging. And if this occurs on a large tree, it's going to be very noticeable, but it really doesn't have an impact on the tree's health in the long run. So you don't need to worry about it. Perhaps the only situation I would be concerned about plants is if I lived in a known cicada hotspot and I had recently planted trees. If the cicadas end up harming the outer maybe 6 to 12 inches of those twigs on a big tree, that's a drop in the bucket. But on a very small young tree, that might end up being a pretty high percentage of the overall tree's canopy. So if you have a recently planted tree, I suggest covering it with fine mesh netting and tie it along the trunk of the tree. That will physically keep the insects off. If the cicadas can't get to the tree, they can't harm it. And one other thing is if you live in a known cicada hotspot and you're planning on planting a tree this year, I would probably wait until July when the cicadas are going to be done for the year and we won't see them again for 17 more years.
Okay, good to know. What are you personally looking forward to?
The thing I'm most excited about it is simply to experience this phenomenon. As I mentioned, it's something that in Wisconsin, you can live here your entire life, and you might only have a handful of opportunities to see this insect in the state. And I turn 40 next year. I could have seen them twice already, but I've missed it both times. So I'm really excited to see them, to experience the sheer numbers of them and experience their singing, because it's this otherworldly science fiction-esque sound that they can produce. So I'm really excited to see and hear them with my own eyes and ears.
That was UW-Madison Extension entomologist P.J. Leash, speaking with WUWM's Lena Tran. You can find more information on the resources he talked about at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about zombie trees, what they are, and why they're endangering Wisconsin communities. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This past winter was the warmest on record. Last spring, we had drought concerns, but this spring was the third wettest on record. As the weather becomes more unpredictable, storms and heavy winds could be creating a phenomenon known as zombie trees. To learn more, I'm joined by arborist Adam Passo from Davy Tree Expert Company in Milwaukee.
So we're going to start with the biggest question. What are zombie trees?
Yes. What are zombie trees? Zombie trees are trees that have been affected somehow by some outside factor. So it could be a high wind from a storm, could be drought. A lot of times it's things that you can't see as an untrained professional that are the scary part of the zombie trees is that, you know, there could be a crack from a high wind that it kind of twisted, and it's just kind of sitting there in purgatory until it does something. It grows or it falls down. You could have drought where on the inside of the tree it kind of dries up, and that's where, You could have some decay happening that you can't see. You know, there's also root issues that could be, you know, not visible to an untrained eye, and a certified arborist could see that there's some girdling roots, there's some root rot. You know, it's just a tree that looks okay. It's hanging in there, but a lot of times it's a slow decline, and then eventually you see the effects, and it's devastating.
So essentially, this is a tree that I might pass and go, fine-looking tree, normal-looking tree, but on the inside, it's dying.
Yep, exactly.
Now, this is an issue that has been growing for some reason. Why are we seeing these increasingly in Wisconsin and seemingly around the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting more extreme weather patterns, you know, higher winds during the spring. You know, it's always who knows what's going to happen. You get some major straight line winds coming through. You could even have some limbs that are hanging up in the canopy of a really leafy tree. Can't see it, but an arborist can definitely tell. And that's when who knows what happens. It can just sit there for months, you know, years even, and then it falls down.
And I guess that really gets to the issue with zombie trees, because you think, well, yeah, sure, you know, trees get sick, they die just like anything else. But it seems like one of the problems here is that these are trees that, for all intents and purposes, look fine and then kind of on a dime can die. And it seems like that's what causes the next problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's times I've been sitting in my truck. This happened recently. I was sitting in my truck. And we had a really heavy wind the day before. I went to go look at a tree that was on a house. I was sitting in there in my truck, and about 15 yards behind me, this huge red oak just falls across the road for no apparent reason. It'd been sitting there, probably compromised from the wind, and it just, boom, down it goes. And it could hit me, could have hit anybody walking along. So it's kind of scary stuff.
For sure. I mean, it's... almost like something falling from the sky, except it is basically falling from the sky to the side of you.
Yeah. It's not a zombie eating brains, but it's just as scary.
Yeah. Now, what can you do? Because it seems like these are issues, at least some of them, that can be solved if you're able to find them.
Yeah, there's ways to protect trees, even if they're compromised. You know, there's cabling, bracing. There's ways that we can help the health of the tree. You know, maybe some pruning that will get rid of the hazard. And then the tree can, you know, trees are really resilient. They can figure out a way to take over whatever was lost. So that energy just gets redirected. And trees will survive at all costs.
Now, you've said a lot of the time it's difficult to know when this has started to happen to a tree. Are there little things that people can look out for to go, oh, this tree might have an issue?
Yeah. Yeah. The first sign is canopy decline. You know, the leaves were really nice size last year. This year, they're a little bit smaller. You can start seeing a little bit more light through the canopy. You know, even in a dense canopy, if right down the middle, you can see light through there, that's probably a bad junction, and it probably needs to be cabled together. If it's a whole kind of decline in the tree, you know, have somebody out. There could be something more sinister going on. We can help. If it's just, you know, an old tree that's kind of in decline, we can help that a lot. But you'll notice maybe a little light color on the bark. You know, it's a real dark bark. And then you see this line of light color. That's a dead giveaway that maybe there's a nasty crack that we can't see all the way through. But it's just the start.
It seems like really the last thing is taking down the whole tree. It seems like there's a variety of intervention methods before then, but when is it that we go, this tree's got to go?
Yeah. If you see some root heaving, you know, there could be the ground coming up a little bit on one side that you didn't really notice the other day. that's a big sign that the roots were severed. Sometimes those roots can be grown back. You'll see a hump around a tree. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a recent thing and the tree is compensated, put a bunch of roots out, and it's stabilized again. But a lot of times that's not going to happen. You know, one side of the tree will fracture, one side will, those cells will compress. Each situation is different. That's what's exciting about tree care, you know? We're all individuals, so are they. So it's just having a trained eye, take a look, and make sure that everybody's safe.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Adam Passo is a certified arborist and district manager for Davy Tree Expert Company in Milwaukee. We spoke late last year, and that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. A community-led tutoring program that started at Milwaukee Public Schools after the pandemic, called Forward Scholars, is no longer supported by federal dollars. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn what's next for the program. Plus, Bubbler Talk looks into how a historic cottage got from Fox Point to Fort Atkinson. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.